As I thought I would probably do, I'm going to toss out all my introduction and just very briefly say that our Unitarian Universalist General Assembly has challenged us very strongly to get on the issue of our vanishing civil rights and usurpation of executive power in our country. I would like, however, to introduce someone who has done some ground plowing, referring back to Frederick Douglass. We have in front of us the first place fifth grade winner of the editorial contest that the Cap Times and the Wisconsin State Journal sponsored. And he's going to introduce the writer of last week's editorial on patriotism. So, Reuben, you're on.
John Nichols is associate editor of the Capital Times and Washington correspondent for The Nation. He is the author of the book Hughes Free Buchanan and co-author of It's the Media, Stupid. The Milwaukee Press Club awarded John first place in the state for his editorial on Madison's Pledge of Allegiance controversy. With considerable dedication, John has covered progressive politics in newspapers and magazines for over 10 years. He even posted articles from Italy during his honeymoon this past August. On September 7th, he was a featured speaker at the Fightin' Bob Fest in Baraboo. Highest praise for John comes from Capital Times editor Dave Zweifel. John is a gem of a journalist, a tireless worker, and a brilliant commentator. He's fiercely proud of his Wisconsin heritage and his family's role in so many of the state's important causes. We're extremely lucky to have him as a member of the staff, and we are extremely lucky to have him here at Prairie. Let's welcome John Nichols.
Significantly weaker introductions by much more esteemed people. Very least, he actually knew it was the Capital Times, not the State Journal. Occasionally get speakers who miss that, so I was delighted to be there. I am also delighted to be with folks here. What a wonderful crowd, and what a good bunch of people. And I must say, I don't think I have ever followed a singing version of the Bill of Rights. Certainly a rare moment. And also that you would that it would have been written to honor my friend and comrade, John Patrick Hunter, who is very active, goes to another Unitarian meeting over at First Unitarian, and would certainly, had he known I was going to be here, he would have sent greetings, I'm sure. Now, I'm a Quaker, not a Unitarian, and so I especially enjoyed the moment of silence. It was a fine moment of silence. We had a moment of silence at my wedding, and the wedding was very carefully programmed, and people were supposed to speak all this time. A friend of ours had arrived late. And he had seen people going through their regular parts of the wedding, but hadn't gotten a program for the wedding. So he arrives late, sees somebody sit down, and sees us go into the moment of silence, which was programmed as part of the wedding. And of course, in Quaker tradition, was moved to speak. And so, right as we went into the moment of silence, which is supposed to be about 5 minutes, he rushes to the podium and starts speaking. And we were all like, we had no idea what was going on. It was only about midway through it that we realized, well, this is a perfect Quaker moment. And I think that also that's one of the wonders of Unitarians as well, is that it's sort of an acceptance that the unexpected, the unprogrammed may be the best part of any event. And I am delighted to be here with you. I'm going to quickly tell one joke and then get right to the point. It's not really a joke. It's actually an accurate story of a Unitarian family that moved to, I believe it was Stoughton, or some smaller town. And the family moved into town, and they were the only Unitarians, but were treated, politely as one. People kind of looked at them a little different than that and didn't really know what was on, but general politeness. And then a couple days after they'd settled in, late at night, they heard a crash out front. And, this is very troubling. The man ran to the front room And moments later, his wife came, and she said, "What is it? What is it?" And the man said, "Keep the children back. Someone's burned a question mark in our front yard." And that is apropos of my discussion today. So we are talking about asking questions, which is a very risky and dangerous thing in these times. You know, I was in Washington on September 11th, and it was an odd thing because the first word I got of it was a call. My publisher's in New York, and my colleague Linda Brazil had thought I was going to be in New York with the publisher as opposed to down in D.C. So the call comes on my cell phone, and she says, "Are you all right?" And I was writing at the time. I said, "Yeah, fine," you know. And she said, "Well, you know, terrorists have hit the World Trade Center, and buildings are on fire. It's this horrible moment." And within a few minutes after that, the plane crashed into the Pentagon, which is about a mile from where my apartment in Washington is. And I was looking. You could look out the window and see the flames coming. And if you know the TV reports on that very tense morning, they said there was another plane in the air, perhaps headed toward the Capitol. I have an apartment a couple blocks from the Capitol. And so this was suddenly you're wrenched out of this very peaceful morning into this intense time. And it's funny that my immediate reaction was, of course, sympathy for the people who had been harmed. That is the only sane and rational reaction any of us can have. But the second reaction I had was, oh boy, because you know, when something like this happens, the first instinct of so many people in power is to abuse it. And yes, there is a need to change how we do things. But there is also, on the part of those of us who know history, a fear that those changes will go to extreme levels. And in the past year, they have. Now, the thing that I got, a couple days after September 11th, I went up to New York and saw friends and saw the Ground Zero site and came back down to Washington. And it struck me, I also saw Midge Miller, by the way. And amazingly enough, on September 11th, the whole world, you know, this is like a day after September 11th, wasn't it? It was on the 11th. Whole world's in crisis. Nobody knows what to do. People are completely destabilized. Midge Miller is out there trying to argue against nuclear weapons. And as members of the House and Senate are standing outside the Capitol, not knowing what to do, because it turns out we had no communication system for our Congress, even in a period of crisis, we tell the President, but we don't tell the Congress that there's a crisis. Interesting notion. Midge is out there grabbing senators and members of the House and saying, you know, national missile defense wouldn't have done anything to stop this. And you know, it was at that moment that I knew America would survive. Because as long as there's a Midge Miller out there trying to keep people focused on the real struggles, it's going to be okay. But I still need a little reassurance. So I got in my car and I drove down to Montpelier in central Virginia, which is James Madison's estate. And I spent a day there, which is a wonderful place. If you haven't gone, you should. Everybody goes to Monticello, which is lovely, but it's about 20 miles away is where Madison's from. And remember that Madison's the one who actually thought we should have a lot of rights. And I was struck, I was reading through some of Madison's papers there, and I was struck by a wonderful quote that he had, because it's one we should keep in mind at this point. He said, "The biggest threat to our rights, to our civil liberties, always is war." Not the threat from outside. Madison never feared the threat from outside. This is a strong, good people. They fought off the most powerful country in the world to become an independent country. He feared the internal threat of war. And he had this wonderful quote. He said that war is the true nurse of executive aggrandizement. And he went on to say, "Of all the enemies of true liberty, war is perhaps the most to be dreaded, because it comprises and develops the germ of every other. War is the parent of armies. From these proceed debts and taxes. And armies and debts and taxes are the known instruments for bringing the many under the domination of the few. In war, too, the discretionary power of the executive is extended. Its influence in dealing out offices Department of Homeland Security. Honors and emoluments is multiplied, and all the means of seducing the minds are added to those of subduing the force of the people. The same malignant aspect in republicanism may be traced in the inequality of fortunes and the opportunities of fraud growing out of a state of war, and in the degeneracy of manner and of morals engendered in both. No nation can preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare. Not Noam Chomsky. James Madison. When he was, and I always remind people, these are the folks who actually sat down and thought a little bit about why you would have a Bill of Rights, why you would have a Constitution. And they're the ones who warned us that continual war, an ongoing war against an ill-defined axis of evil, becomes ultimately a threat to our freedom, to our liberty. So much of this current period has been framed as a struggle to advance freedom beyond our borders. And yet, in so many senses, it has been a period of clamping down on freedom within our borders. And what am I talking about? I'm not simply talking about the USA Patriot Act. And I think most of you are familiar with it, but if you're not, I highly recommend that you go to Russ Feingold's website. You can read about the only member of the entire US Senate that opposed the most serious assault on civil liberties in our lifetime. The only member, Russ Feingold. But it's beyond the USA Patriot Act. I think that what I really want to begin our discussion with today is to suggest a broader vision of civil rights, civil liberties, constitutional protections. We can go to individual components in the question period, but this is the main thing that I want to emphasize to you. When they founded this country, they did not write a Bill of Rights or even the broad Constitution with the purpose of ensuring your freedom or your liberty or your ability to do what you want or your license to do as you choose. They wrote a framework for civil society. They wrote a framework within which we could interact and play well together. The concept was, and remember, this is a very radical concept, very appropriate for Unitarians. They didn't believe in the divine right of kings. And you understand how radical that was at that time? Most people in the educated or developed places of this whole planet believed in 1776 that whoever ruled was placed there by God. You had the divine right to hold that position. The founders of this country said no. Individual citizens had the right to govern and guide. But if you take out that divine right, if you take out God putting a person in charge, and if you take out a king with an army that he can direct, or a queen with an army, where's our judge? Queen Anne, I'm so delighted that we're no longer worshiping Queen Anne. And if you take that off and you say, it's up to all of you, then you have to have a basic set of rules by which you interact. You have to have a basic structure by which it all works. And the founders of this country, when they put their mention of religion in there, did not do it with the purpose of talking about, you know, all the structures and debates we have on religion. Now, they simply wanted to say, you know, look, as we see this thing working, you can practice whatever religion you want, that's fine. When they put in their freedom of the press, they didn't intend that Rupert Murdoch would set up Fox TV. They intended that there would be a broad diversity. Everybody could go the way they wanted, and it would be the divine intention of this country that what you did was fine, that you'd have a cacophony of media. And when they set up freedom of the press, freedom of speech, they intended that everyone could have their say in a civil, functional debate that would work. Here's where our crisis has come in. Yes, we should worry about the USA Patriot Act, largely because of the terrible things it has done to legal immigrants in this country and to people who may be of dubious legality, like most of our ancestors when they came to this country. We should worry about it a lot. We should also worry about the horrific components of the USA Patriot Act that allow secret grand juries, secret judges, to push the hand of government deeper into our internet, into our mail, and into our homes than ever in the history of this country. Remember that today, right now, as you sit here, federal agents could be searching your home, going through it, going through all of your papers, photographing whatever they want, then leaving them and locking the door and never telling you, and you would never know. That is a component of the USA Patriot Act, detailed in it. So there's horrible things within it. But let me tell you, as bad as it is, it is equally bad that we are in an undeclared war today. It is equally bad that our Congress has not risen to its basic constitutional responsibility within this framework of civil society to engage in that way. It is equally bad that our media, given so much freedom by our founders, again, within that framework of a functional civil society, by and large cheerleads for an absurd, comic approach to our interactions with the rest of the world. And finally, it is most troubling that in most of America, there are people, I would argue a majority of Americans, who feel qualms, concerns, uncertainty about whether they can ask the questions and pose the challenges that are the demand of citizens in a civil, functional society. We have had a terrible diminution of our Constitution in the last year. It is not the passage of the USA Patriot Act. It is not assaults on civil liberties. If we limit it to that, by and large, we white, middle-class, upper-class Madisonians make it a concern of the other. We have to recognize that the assault is much broader. It is on that whole framework that makes our society work. And we have some very serious responsibilities at this point. I'm going to quickly finish up here and just tell you, and we can talk much more about specific aspects, but to my mind, I think there are three responsibilities that we as citizens have, and we ought to take them very, very seriously. Number one, Wisconsin, my home state. I'm a seventh generation Wisconsinite. I've never been prouder of this state than I am right now. Wisconsin had the highest level of opposition to the U.S. Patriot Act in our Congress. With Russ Feingold, Tammy Baldwin, Dave Obie, Tom Barrett, Gerald Kutschka, we had more people voting against it than any other state in the country. Now that's pathetic, because it means that most other states, you know, like cool, hip California, New York, forget them, right? You know, all the big intellectual hot, you gotta come out to the rural Midwest and find people that actually take some of this stuff seriously. But we did have them, so we have a base here. But we cannot just pat a Russ Feingold or a Tammy Baldwin on the back. What we have to say is, as tough as it is your job, Russ Feingold, as the chair of the Constitution Subcommittee of the Senate Judiciary Committee. It is your job, Tammy Baldwin, as a member of the Judiciary Committee in the U.S. House of Representatives, to begin the process of deconstructing the USA Patriot Act. We need to get that law off the books. It should never have been there in the first place. And when you talk to your elected representatives, that's a starting point. To say, we go back from where we were a year ago to a rational place, number one. Number two, we have to begin to demand of citizens that our Congress do its job. For the last year, they have collected their paychecks, by and large, irresponsibly. They had no right to have those checks because they didn't do their work. You have a responsibility to advise and consent with an executive, especially an executive who, as best we can tell, hasn't spent a lot of time thinking about the rest of the world. And that responsibility of advise and consent has not been asserted up to this point. As we edge toward an Iraq war, it is possible it will be asserted. But I emphasize, possible. Don't be led into the fantasy that we will have a real debate on the Iraq war. That is not guaranteed. President Bush has said he will consult with Congress. We have no idea where that's going to take us. Tammy Baldwin, to her great credit, I was talking to her yesterday, spent the last week there trying to figure out how many people there are in the House to press for an actual vote on whether to go to war with Iraq. And what she will tell you is it's a very discouraging process. So we as citizens have a real responsibility to start talking to our members of Congress. And remember, I know there's a lot of people at Prairie UU who think that your only representatives are Tammy Baldwin and Russ Feingold. You also got Herb Cole. You've also got a lot of other representatives around this state who need to hear from Wisconsinites and be told that they should go the route that Tammy and Russ have already indicated they will go. Believe me, most important call you can make in the next week, to Herb Kohl's office. Russ Feingold needs that ally. He shouldn't be left out there alone demanding that our Constitution be obeyed. Final thing. This is the easiest and the hardest. Most folks here already did it very well. Dissent. Speak out. Raise your view. I don't care if you do believe in going to war with Iraq, although I'd really like to have a good debate with you later today. But I don't mind what you believe, but I do want people to get highly engaged. One of the problems that we had in this town a year ago, and it's amazing that it's within the last year, we had a debate over the Pledge of Allegiance in Madison, whether we should force people to say the Pledge of Allegiance. And I believe that debate would have gone dramatically differently today than it did at that time. We're in a period of great fear, uncertainty. People didn't know how to respond. I saw mothers crying because they were afraid to speak up. They were so concerned for their child. They were so worried about what was all going on. I saw teachers terrified. I think we've moved a long way beyond it. But I will tell you something. Madison came through that pledge debate healthier than just about any town in America because so many people were willing to speak up and were willing to dissent. The incredible thing was, if you only listen to the buzz, right? And yet enough people spoke up, there was enough challenging. Bill Keyes actually apparently, you know, this amazing backbone, which, you know, when he dies, they're gonna put this backbone into a museum. Bill Keyes stood his ground, and instead of being run out of politics, is now the president of the school board. Madison's a special place. Madison knows how to dissent, but I'll tell you something. You need to do it more. You need to raise your voices louder, because the counterbalance to all that has been done to our Constitution in the last year is not simply laws. It is not simply legislative action. It is not something official or far away. The counterbalance is the assertion of those rights in your everyday life with your friends and neighbors. Because when you start to speak up, you become like the kid who says that the emperor has no clothes, right? If you say to your neighbor, well, you know, I still can't figure out why we're supposed to go to war with Iraq, your neighbor has to start to think about it. Simply asking questions remains the most radical act, and it also remains the most true and wise continuation of James Madison's challenge to us. In a time of war, when all of our liberties are most threatened, our number one responsibility as Americans is to make sure that those liberties are asserted. Thank you.
Okay, now it's time for the real prayer and sacrament. We'll open the floor to questions, discussions, not to lectures, please. Questions, discussions, and please make them brief.
Let's start with the guy in the back there. Good question. Very good. Number one, civil liberties the people had on September 11th? Same as any of the rest of us. Same as anybody who dies in any situation. You got your rights up to that day. You don't have them after. It's a simple reality. Doesn't mean we lack sympathy for them, but I fear sometimes the suggestion that because something horrible happened to those people, we should allow something horrible to happen to our broader constitutional and civil society. But let me suggest to you about keeping safe, keeping secure. I referenced Madison at the start of the speech. James Madison was president in 1814, 1815, when we had the worst terrorism ever to be experienced in this country. Washington, D.C. was burned by the British. They were going up and down the eastern seaboard, burning up cities, destroying federal buildings, the Capitol itself. White House was burned. And during that same time, there was not a suspension of rights. In fact, Madison fought hard to make sure that there would not be any attempt to suspend rights. The incredible thing was that during the course of this war, with British soldiers on U.S. ground, there was a serious debate in the U.S. Senate on whether to continue funding the U.S. Army. And a third of U.S. senators at that time voted against doing so, because they said the war should be fought by local militias, not the army. And obviously, I'm not sure that was the wisest move, but that willingness to do that debate, even in a time of tremendous threat, when they're literally burning the buildings in which you meet, is, I think, a good lesson for us. We often hearken back to times when rights have been suspended, when we put the Japanese into concentration camps during World War II. And it wasn't just Japanese, it was Germans and Italians from right here in Wisconsin. We talk about that and we think, well, you see, you just have to, in a time of war, suspend liberties. You have to give them up. In fact, the people who founded this country said that's exactly when you don't do it. And I'll give you one final thought in my regard, from my standpoint. I think there's good debate on this. My belief is that in the narrowing of discussion and the narrowing of discourse since September 11th, and there's been an immense pressure to narrow it, we have cheated ourselves of a lot of good ideas and good discourse. And I think we've made ourselves a weaker country, a lesser country, because we have narrowed the discourse. And I hear all the time, when I go out and talk in Baraboo and Ashland and all sorts of rural places, people with really sound ideas about how the U.S. should be approaching this moment. And yet I never hear those ideas on our television. I never hear those ideas in our broad national discourse. I rarely hear them in our Congress. And so I think a narrowing of discourse, a narrowing of liberty, is exactly the wrong thing to do at a time of threat. I think your point is well taken. Now let me offer my thought and just say that I don't necessarily believe that the attacks on September 11th were a direct outgrowth of U.S. actions. Because, and I'll tell you this, look, Osama bin Laden, the people who actually study the guy will tell you that he represents a narrow sector of Islam which has objections to the U.S. that are so obscure that the U.S. might have had a hard time even figuring them out, and many other people might have had a hard time figuring out, putting bases in Saudi Arabia and stuff like that. But your broad question is exactly appropriate, because there's no question that as part of the post-September 11th discourse, we should have talked about this question, as Gore Vidal does with his wonderful book, you know, why do they hate us so much? Well, there are a lot of people that are fiercely angry at the United States. They are angry enough to take extreme acts. Now, you can either say that they're nuts, right, that they must be crazy, which is essentially the official line at this point. Or you can say, look, we need to figure that out. We need to figure out what the roots are of a lot of this anger and to understand why someone who might never have attacked, might never have done what happened on September 11th, might never have flown a plane into the World Trade Center or the Pentagon, would yet be delighted in putting an Osama bin Laden screensaver on their computer, as kids in the most elite schools of Pakistan did. Now there's something there that needs to be worked on. And I'll give you one other thing that I think needs to be worked on as well. After September 11th, there was a dramatic outpouring of sympathy for the United States from around the world. It was astounding. And you know, in Iran, people marched in the streets. The place where you had the whole embassy crisis and all that, people marched in the streets in sympathy with those who had died, all over the world. And to my view, instead of saying, as a wise president would have, look, this is our time to truly engage with the rest of the world, to begin to talk, to begin to think, to begin to find real relationships, we have asserted a unilateralist approach to almost every question since. And now, amazingly enough, here these people actually come out and march in the street in sympathy with the United States. And then a matter of weeks later, they're told that they're part of the axis of evil, that, you know, if we can't figure out who else to get, we'll get them. We have had a foolish response that grows out of a long period of sense that you can assert whatever you want around the world, rather than finally at this moment opening the door and saying, you know, yeah, we ought to start listening. Look, I think that I believe that number one, it is very important to remember the absurdity of these things and to talk about it in a realistic way. one of the things that allows so much, so many assaults on our rights is a sense that this is for real, that it is rational. And I gotta tell you, I've been everywhere, but I travel a lot around the world. I've spent a lot of time in Africa, a lot of time in India, a lot of time in Southern Asia. And you know what? When I tell people I'm from Wisconsin, it usually invites one of the blanker stares I've ever seen. And I know the theory that, you know, well, if they really want to get us, they'll come and find Madison and attack us. Now I understand. I know the theory of it. But an element of realism needs to come into play here. And also, I will go so far as to suggest, I think that over on Breeze Terrace in this incident, that there is one of the worst sorts of abuses. Because I think the university and the city are in a little bit of a sparring match on this. And I think the assertion of a more forceful university role in stopping more cars and extending the time has as much to do with a local sparring match over control of traffic as it has to do with terrorism. And yet, because of this moment, people are allowed to take local sparring matches, local grievances, and turn them into, you know, this national security issue. And I think we ought to talk bluntly about things like that. And remember that it ain't just people here in Madison. We have a president of the United States and a political staff in his office, Karl Rove, who spend an immense amount of time thinking about how to take advantage of this moment for political purposes. And I don't speak out of school. Rove said it to the Republican National Committee. If this fall's election is about economic issues, the Democrats will prevail. If we can make it about national security issues, Republicans have a chance of winning. So what are we hearing about in the run-up to the 2002 elections? Again and again and again, the threat from Iraq rather than our economy. If we really had our act together as a country, and I think we do in so many ways, let me tell you, I've got a lot of criticism of America, but I'm like the most patriotic person you're ever gonna meet. I go to those Memorial Day parades, I still get a tear in my eye when I see the flag go by. I love this country to pieces. I love where I'm from within it, this great northern, you know, dissenting populist region we come from. Tommy Thompson aside. You know, and yet, so many times we blow such logical opportunities. The damn terrorists hit the World Trade Center on primary election day in New York. They interrupted an election. Would it not be wise as a country to say that there is no better way to fight terrorism than to vote? There is no better way to assert basic American principles than to vote. Instead, the President of the United States got on television and said the most basic, essential way to assert our values is to shop. And I asked my Aunt Carrie, she's 90 years old, and I said, Aunt Carrie, you know, is there, they compared September 11th to December 7th. So you were around on December 7th. You know, what did you do the next day? Did you go shopping? She said, no, I think it involved collecting metal scraps from our neighbors. And the bottom line is that we have so allowed our civic values to diminish that we didn't even think to assert that natural connection. You know, our friend here asked about all the things that might have led around the world to September 11th, all the past actions of the U.S. Well, if there are causes and links and connections, you know, if people are really mad about September 11th, why in God's name wouldn't you say there's one way to get back at them? Vote and express your views as a citizen. Use these freedoms, and instead, since September 11th, voter turnout nationally has been on a decline, not an increase. Citizenship has not risen, it has fallen. And I have to tell you, I think it has an awful lot to do with this narrowing of the discourse, this pushing in rather than a sense of, you know, we're gonna trust our people. So my answer for you, tell them it was primary day that those planes hit, that you have, as a patriot, you have a responsibility to go vote. I think your point's well taken, but one to be cautious about. I'm always careful about the comparisons to Nazis. They're often so easy to do. Let me make a comparison right here to America. As a young man, I had a wonderful opportunity to meet a lot of people, older political leaders who had served in Congress in the 1940s. or just thereafter. And people whose names we all know, and who were, you know, Jennings Randolph, the former senator from West Virginia, Robert Byrd, still a senator today. And, you know, that's amazing. You know, but the incredible thing about it is that you will find that in folks who were serving in the U.S. Congress during the 1940s and on the courts, the thing that they will bring up again and again, if you say, well, what was the worst thing you did? What was the stupidest thing you did? What do you regret most in your career? They invariably say, going along with the internment of the Japanese, the Germans, the Italians in America. And they'd be very blunt about it. And so war, it isn't just Nazis that in a time of war do things that are fundamentally wrong. It is sometimes Americans who actually mean well, who do things that they end up regretting at deep fundamental levels. We've apologized for a lot of what we did in World War II, yet it was, you know, there's so much nobility, you know, and what so many people did during that war, and yet we felt, you know, as a country needs to apologize. And it was because people allowed war to cause them to do dumb things. I'll tell you something. This country is dramatically more secure when we are more free. If you have any faith in the American experiment whatsoever, you have to believe that we are by and large a decent people. Given good information and a chance to act upon it, we will do the right thing. When we narrow that information, when we limit our ability to discourse, when we limit our ability to act, we end up doing things that we will regret, often for the rest of our lives. And that's, I'm so proud of a Russ Feingold, for instance. He's not a perfect guy, like he voted for Ashcroft. But I'll tell you, Dan, I am proud of him because a month after that attack, to stand there in the U.S. Senate, and when every single other member was going the other way, to say no. I mean, he's the one who 50 years from now, they'll talk about, not the people that voted the wrong way. We'll see how cynical you are. I write a column for The Nation magazine, and in the issue that just came out on Friday, that's my column is basically about that issue. But what I do point out, and I think it's really important, don't just get mad at Karl Rove. Get mad at the Democratic Party and our Democratic representatives in Congress. They are supposed to be an opposition party. As it happens right now, the wisest and noisiest opposition has come from Republicans. And I'll tell you why they've objected. There actually are a few Republicans who worry about the budget deficit. People like Dick Armey. Now, I know his name sounds like a gay cabaret show, but that man, and I've got no love of Dick Armey whatsoever, but I've got to tell you, he worries a lot about the deficit. And he knows what the reality is, so he's come out. But so has Jim Leach, the congressman from just over the border in Iowa. And so he's like, hell, everybody that worked for Dad Bush is against the thing. And so what I'm telling you is, if all of these Republicans can speak up so loudly, Ron Paul, the right-wing nut congressman from Texas, put out a wonderful letter on it just last week. I was talking to Tammy about it. Tammy said, I wish that some Democrats would say this kind of thing. Tammy actually has been pretty good. Dennis Kucinich has been good. But Tom Daschle needs to stand up and say no. It's going to be hard. It's going to require leadership. But that's going to, the only way we stop what I believe is, your scenario is exactly right. One more question, this gentleman right here. To my mind, you know, and I've thought a lot about this, because after September 11th, I don't think it's enough for progressives and people, as I, a Quaker, to simply say, well, there should be no response. For two reasons. Number one, you marginalize yourself out of the debate altogether, because clearly there will be a response. You need to be a part of the debate on what that response should be. Two, I think even as a Quaker, a person who is opposed to violence, I think it is certainly appropriate to bring people to justice for fundamental wrongdoing. Where I think the war in Afghanistan went wrong immediately was the fact that it was called a war. It should have been, this is a police issue. These are 20 nuts from Saudi Arabia. Most of them. They trained some in Afghanistan, but now we're suddenly, as soon as we want to go to war with Iraq, now we find out, oh, maybe they trained in Iraq. You know, suddenly their training grounds seem to move real rapidly. These were mobile criminals and there is a rational police response to it. And it may involve the military, it may be very aggressive. I accept that reality. But what was done in Afghanistan, I mean, let's be real clear about this situation. In Afghanistan, we know that we have bombed and killed thousands of civilians. We know also that we have forced a regime change, but what we do not know at this point is whether that regime change will last. We know that an incredibly unstable country remains incredibly unstable. And I'm not saying that the Taliban should have remained in power. They're a horrible bunch of folks. But what I am suggesting is that our response on the ground there has not been a wise or a well-thought response. It has, by and large, been exactly what President Bush himself said we shouldn't do, which is a rash, you know, kind of ill-thought response. It was. And, you know, when they bombed that wedding over there that we heard so much about, you know, look, I understand in times of war, horrible things happen. But remember, that was long after most Americans, you know what the average response polling to that bombing was? I didn't know we were still at war. People didn't know we were still bombing. And we are still bombing today. And to my mind, we need to have a fundamental rethink of our strategy. That's number one. Number two, I think what's going on in Afghanistan is the best argument against a war in Iraq. Because Mark Green, the very conservative Republican congressman from up in northern Wisconsin, went to Afghanistan on his August break. You know what he came back and said? We shouldn't go to war with Iraq. Why? Because there is so much unfinished business in Afghanistan. We have engaged as a country in a fundamental way with that place, for good or ill, and we have not begun to address everything that's been churned there. And I think that's the rational response, that we have now put ourselves deeply into that situation. We have to think a lot about it, and we have to really ask ourselves fundamental questions about how good a job we've done when the guy we inserted, who all of us like because he speaks English and wears cool clothes. No, he's a very stylish man, you know? But when the guy we inserted into power has to be guarded not by his own people but by U.S. Marines, whenever that happens, that's when Americans ought to start asking whether we're doing it right. I thank you so much for taking the time to listen.